You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, November 30th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building. In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Yes, folks, you know how I thought my cold would be much better today?
I don't think so.
Yet we will endeavor to persevere. Today on the program, Jeff Madrick, senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. He'll be talking to us about the European debt crisis. And also on just how messed up our government's relationship with Wall Street is. And then later in the program, Tina Dupuy, she was on the streets last night in L.A. as 1,400 cops arrested around 200 Occupy L.A.ers. I don't know if she was one of the pool reporters because, you know, there's a very limited amount of press who are allowed to cover that type of thing.
I don't think she works for the local ABC, Fox, NBC affiliate because that's pretty much all that was there.
Right. Right. We will get a report from her on that. In the meantime... Up to 2 million people on strike, public workers in Great Britain as we speak, a nationwide public sector strike. This is the largest strike in Great Britain in 30 years. I don't know. You know, in Europe, labor understands the value of their labor, and sometimes they will withhold it. You're looking at about one-third of all public service workers in Great Britain. And they're going to feel it over there. Of course, Great Britain has been engaged in a program of austerity for over a year now, and it has destroyed their economy. And that is the problem that's facing all of Europe, is that their response to the financial crisis has been to impose austerity, and that just makes things worse. We got to take a break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Jeff Madrick about that European financial crisis and the steps that the Fed... our Fed took today to ease some of that crisis. I think it's probably a Band-Aid, but a Band-Aid nevertheless. We'll be right back.
I cut my fingers on the way. On the way. The wave's slipping away. I took my feelings on. You made me untouchable for life. Yeah, yeah, and you wasn't alone. It hit me like a toll.
turned my feelings on. I turned my feelings on the side. Yeah, yeah. Like I'm gonna ignite. I saw them stars go off. I saw them stars go off at night.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Jeff Madrick, senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, author of Age of Greed. Welcome back to the program, Jeff.
Nice to speak to you, Sam.
Jeff, let's start with what's been going on in Europe. Can you give us just... I'm sorry?
Oh, no, that wasn't me. That was my computer.
Oh, okay. Give me a general sense of what the European debt crisis is really about.
Well, in a nutshell, people overborrowed and overlent. You know, the Germans are seen somehow in much of the media as the good, prudent guys. But German banks lent like crazy, and the Germans could only maintain their prudent economy, quote unquote, because people in Greece and Spain, Portugal, Belgium, and so forth bought the goods they were exporting. So this was simply an unsustainable set of issues provoked into crisis, in fact, by the U.S. crisis first, and then out of control. The upshot is that Europe has to do what the U.S. did at the end of 2008, the combination of TARP and extreme Federal Reserve easing in order to stop the bleeding. We stopped the bleeding. We did not do in that period, and what we failed at miserably was get the banks to start lending again and forgive mortgage and get mortgage relief, so we don't have much of an economy right now. But they've got to do what we did, and they are buried in their historical antagonisms towards each other and their nationalism. I myself actually believe in the Europe project. I believe ultimately they will be able to get their act together. But the moment Germany in particular is hesitating to take what are giant strides needed to stop this bleeding, giant lending, because it will get worse if they don't do this now. So it's a choice between the bad and the very bad. But the bad can get them back on track and make this Europe project, this Europe unification project, work. And let me just say one other thing, Sam. People forget the history of America. America did not unify easily. Not least, we fought a civil war to remain unified. It is not easy to unify. So disparagement of Europe, people should be careful about it. Martin Feldstein wrote yet another disparaging piece, and it's an oversimplification of the way history works.
Now, all right, so today the Fed essentially, I guess, made it much cheaper for the banks in Europe to borrow dollars. What is that? What are the implications of that?
It's not merely easier to borrow dollars. They made dollars available to them so that they could boast. The banks are starting to fail in Europe because they have lots of debts. They own a lot of sovereign debt. fail is too strong a word. Let's be cautious. The banks are in much deeper trouble than they were in before. So they need money to bolster their finances. The Fed, through the swap process, is now making that money available. And my guess is the Fed has been the leader on this. But finally, the European Central Bank, the Federal Reserve of the Unified Europe, the Eurozone, I should say, the 17 nations of the Eurozone, is participating as well. They are, however, the main villain in the piece. They do not want to do what our Fed did, which was ease policy radically for the moment. And that's probably the only way to hold Europe together. I think they ultimately will. This is a step in the right direction. It doesn't mean that we don't have a huge credit load to deal with in the future, but the patient could die if we don't do what we have to do now.
Right. I mean, it seems to me that somebody's going to have to take a big haircut here, and there's a real desire to have essentially, it come in the form of austerity. But the problem is that austerity creates even more of a problem because it kills growth. And therefore, you start to diminish revenues, and the problem starts all over again.
I completely agree with that. That's why I started by saying Germany has a moral obligation and a practical obligation as the rich man of Europe to save these other nations without drastic austerity means. That's what I was trying to get at when I said that Germany benefited from the same process that is now put Greece and Spain and Portugal and so on under extreme pressure. The way you relieve austerity, you can begin to tighten some of the policies, but the way you relieve it is to increase transfer payments, just like we do in the U.S. We have Social Security that goes to Alabama and Nevada and California, suffering states, and unemployment insurance and so forth. They need to be able to make transfer payments, and they need to be able to raise money throughout the country, Europe-wide money, that is the equivalent of our treasury securities, so they can go in and reduce these debts, which economists call restructuring these debts, so that it's not severe on these people. It has been very severe in Greece, and the idea that there is so much disparagement of the Greeks for so-called irresponsibility, and in truth, Sam, some of it has been irresponsible, but this disparagement that I find basically a prejudice is very disturbing. So I agree with you. We need serious balance here. We can't take it out on poor people all the time. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Well, this mentality, I mean, because the one thing that I think is clear on both sides of the Atlantic is that there's this mentality of, you know, there are two parties to a loan. And so if a loan goes bad, the responsibility is also on the person who makes the loan. I mean, theoretically, that's why people get interest when they make a loan, right? Because there's going to be risk.
Yeah, it's worse than that even, Sam, and I agree with you. And I was trying to cover a little of that in my opening answer. It's worse than that. Germany benefited by lending money to Greece. Because Greece bought their products. It wasn't only the interest on the loans they made by which they benefited. Greece bought their products. China benefited by lending to America because we bought their products. So it is a totally interdependent system. And the idea that one party is morally superior to the other party, which seems to be the stance adopted by the media, is just wrong. Both parties have to compromise on this, and the rich, strong party is not. That's not especially new in history.
And let's overlay that onto what has taken place in this country over the past couple of years in terms of our financial problems. When you see a story like that, Henry Paulson was essentially sitting around with his buddies from Goldman Sachs, former Goldman Sachs guys, and giving them what appears, at least if you're receiving it and act upon it, inside information as to what the government is going to do, and essentially helping these hedge fund managers. The whole theory seems to be that we need to save the institutions that loan money, and it's got to come out of the hide out of the people they have loaned it to.
Yeah, it's very disturbing that what people have to understand is this inside information issue. Paulson basically, we now know, told these dozen hedge fund managers that they were going to save Fannie and Freddie by making a conservatorship, which would basically wipe out the stock. So the stock would go, for example, purposes from 10 to zero or 10 to a dollar or something like that. Good information if you get it ahead of time, because then you can sell that stock. But who are you selling it to? People who don't have the same information. Suckers, really, who are willing to pay $10 for Fannie Mae to this hedge fund manager if they acted on it. We don't know they did. Because they don't know what he knows, that it's going to zero shortly. It's outrageous taking advantage of people who are not in the in crowd. And the in crowd on Wall Street is seeped into Washington. It hasn't seeped in. It's been there in Washington. And it's taken, and it's quite clear that Paulson did not have a moral break on his activities. He did not. They share a set of values. I believe this is an evidence of it, a set of values that they somehow deserve this privileged status, privileged information, and they are taking advantage of what I think somewhere, not explicitly, but somewhere in their minds is taking advantage of the suckers. They don't say that. They don't tell that to their kids or their religious leaders or so forth. But that's what it amounts to. We are a privileged set of beings. We don't make money because we're brilliant. We make money because we have this track of information.
I know you've got to go in just a minute, but I mean, isn't this these actions when we see Hank Paulson doing this sort of on a sort of a micro level, you know? I mean, there's other stories. I think in Andrew Ross Sorkin's book, of him meeting with Goldman Sachs when they were having a retreat in Moscow during this time too. I mean, so we have to assume this was fairly ongoing. But doesn't this also doesn't this sort of mentality also taint the entire policy that has been pursued by the elites in this country? Whereas, you know, we can bail out the banks as opposed to just going to the root of the problem and helping homeowners, for instance.
I think it definitely did. It certainly colored TARP and even, frankly, I hate to say this, even the Obama administration. You probably agree with me on this.
I do.
They were the same. These people in Washington calling the shots, by and large, had the same value system as the people on Wall Street. They did not really see a separation. And definitely, they should have been bailing out mortgage holders who were clearly abused and exploited. Some idea that, you know, we all buy, what, 1, 2, 3 mortgages in our life, and we're supposed to really know the complexities of the mortgage business when we buy a house. Come on, how absurd. We all depend on our mortgage bankers and brokers and assume they're telling us the truth. And that's where the relief should have gone. It should have gone to the banks as well, as long as it was coupled with relief for the mortgages, as long as it was coupled with restrictions on compensation. I thought there should have been an excess profits tax immediately, and there should have been requirements to make loans. But because exactly of this kind of mentality, the people in charge, Paulson, Geithner, to a lesser degree, Bernanke, who I think has learned some lessons, and carried on into the Obama administration and some of his economic advisors. I don't know all the stories, needless to say. It definitely resulted in policy that's kept us from expanding rapidly or even moderately since then.
Jeff Madrick, senior fellow from the Roosevelt Institute, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate you taking the time.
Sam, thanks for inviting me. Take care now.
Bye-bye. All right, folks, take a quick break. We'll come back, tell you about the one guy who's actually calling for more regulation of the banks. It may surprise you.
Everybody's coming home for lunch these days. Last night there were skinheads on my lawn. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Some people say that bowling alley's got big legs. Forget what it was.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. God, my voice is lousy today. So I was mentioning, God, I'm so annoyed. Well, I'm generally annoyed right now because, you know, the one thing I got is my voice. So when I don't have my voice, it's just annoying. But this is also annoying. Because on one hand, yesterday, story about Huntsman calling on Monday for a major financial overhaul that would break up the big, too big to fail banks. He was calling for proposals that never even made it into Dodd-Frank. He called to set a limit on bank size relative to the size of the economy and apply a variety of taxes against banks to make it costly to exceed that limit. Banks could still choose to get bigger, but if they did that, they would pay essentially a surtax. And apparently that surtax would be applied to lowering the tax rates of other industries. So at least from a political standpoint, you'd get these other industries obviously lobbying to impose that tax. He also came out very strongly about the lack of the Justice Department's pursuit of fraudulent mortgages. And he sides with Schneiderman and Biden, who have essentially rejected Iowa's Tom Miller's attorney general's deal that he's trying to make with the banks. It's all good stuff. And it would be nice if he was able to enter into the debate tomorrow night and get some traction on these ideas, which is obviously what he was attempting to do. Of course, he's such a moron, like every single one of the Republican candidates. I'm not saying I would vote for this guy, and he's never going to be president, but these are ideas that would be nice to have in the debate. And of course, this guy is such an idiot. He came out and he referred to the women who have, well, I mean, I guess accused Herman Cain of sexual harassment and were confirmed, not accused or alleged, I mean confirmed, were paid off by Herman Cain, probably just because he wanted to pay them off, or his institution wanted to pay them off, probably for no reason, referred to them as bimbos. You know, what an idiot. Just these Republican candidates, just from just a sheer political competence, like you have one message that may resonate in some tiny way and differentiate you from those other idiots on the stage. And the fact that you cannot get past the fact that you see, you know, women as essentially chattel, dooms you at the one opportunity that you have to maybe have a slight uptick in the polls. Unbelievable.
I mean, Herman Cain, I mean, there's that empty space now that Herman Cain's going down, and it seems like they're all just messing up as soon as that spot became available. I mean, yesterday, Rick Perry had another gaffe with saying he wanted everyone who is over the age of 21 to vote when people who are 18 and older can vote.
You know, this is when you start to think, like, yes, the guys who believe that we're ruled by interterrestrials and the Illuminati, and they just want, you know, they're sitting in a room somewhere pulling the strings. I mean, and so what they've done is they've just assembled the most idiotic crew of Republicans to run against Obama because they really want Obama to win, but they want to make it look like it's actually an election. Does Rick Perry really not realize that people can vote at age 18? Is there not, can he not find the proper medication mix? Seriously. And Newt Gingrich? It's just a joke. It's just an absolute joke. There was another story. I don't know why it's not in my stack. I don't know where it went. But there, and I've been saying this, I think I said it yesterday, but I've been saying this over and over again, and it is in fact the case. The reason why Mitt Romney has had such problems in the Republican Party is because he's a Mormon. There's just simply, I mean, yes, he's a stiff, and he's a constant flip-flopper. But the Republican Party, the electoral base, is made up of fundamentalists who believe that Mitt Romney goes into, you know, his lair at night, and they think that he prays to the devil. According to a poll that was released, I guess, 2 days ago, more than 4 in 10 American voters said they're uncomfortable with the idea of a Mormon in the White House. Public Religion Research Institute faces an identity problem among those who already know he's a Mormon and those who don't but generally have qualms about the faith. Poll found evangelicals are warming to Romney's chief rival, businessman Herman Cain, and that the group, also the group that harbors the most unease with Mormonism amongst all religious groups. Among white evangelical voters, 47% expressed discomfort with a Mormon president. Are there any really other blocks of voters in the Republican Party other than white evangelical voters? And half of them have an issue with the fact that he's, I mean, that's his problem.
It's funny they don't like him because he's a Mormon, yet the guy who's polling number one right now, Newt Gingrich, is the one who's had multiple wives.
Right. Yes. Touche. But no, they don't mind that Gingrich, because look, the bottom line with the Republican Party, and we'll talk more about this on Friday when Cliff gets here, because we'll have the, but if you want to know who's going to zoom to the top, it is the candidate that expresses the most vitriolic hatred for liberals at any given time until they prove themselves just too stupid to carry that banner. It's what happened to Michelle Bachmann. It's what happened to Rick Perry. It's what happened to Herman Cain. They're not literally, they're not voting on policy or ideas. It is how much disdain is expressed for liberals and not liberal ideas. Liberals. Which one of them is best suited to be a Fox talking head? And I'm not being facetious here. I mean, literally, that is what they look for. And Romney just does not come out and feel as comfortable sort of mocking liberals and the press. And that's why Gingrich is going to the I mean, look, there is story after story after story coming out about how, I mean, frankly, there's a story in the Times about, and it's not even worth talking about because everybody knows that Newt Gingrich is a complete con man. I think the longer Newt Gingrich stays in this race, the issue isn't whether or not the issue is whether or not he's facing criminal charges for his activities that are supposedly not lobby oriented, but are clearly lobbying. He's not registered as a lobbyist, but you know, apparently the New York Times found a backdoor exit into their website that they use for their clients in you know, Newt Gingrich's lobby outfit, and they're lobbying.
You mean Newt Gingrich is not the highest paid historian of all time?
Well, it depends on how you define history. If you define history as lobbying, then yes, no, I don't know. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk to Tina Dupuy. She was on the ground last night in L.A. when Occupy L.A. was evicted. We'll be right back after this.
Presidents, we're all congressmen, we're all cops, and waiting with the workers of the world. There is the elite and the dispossessed, and it's only about survival. Who has skill to play the game for all it's worth? Reaching out, scared kind of perfection. Let's try and keep as much emotion out of this as possible. Try not to remember any names. We'll do it for a country, for people, for more vision. United will make them remember our history. Or how we like to be told.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. On the phone, the... What, are you the managing editor?
Yeah, you said director on your website there. I'm a really bossy editor. How's that? We can compromise.
Okay. I screwed up. Sorry. Managing editor of crooksandliars.com, among the like three other jobs you seem to have.
I do.
Tina Dupuy.
I do. I'm the 99%.
You're working overtime.
All the time.
So last night, I woke up in the middle of the night because I was sick. I was coughing. And whenever I'm in that situation, I run to my computer and look on Twitter to see what's going on. And sure enough, they were evicting the Occupy LA. The cops were. And I saw you were in the thick of it. So tell us what happened.
Well, I got a text from my source at the LA Times who said, "Yeah, you should probably get down here." And I showed up, and there were probably three times as many media trucks as I'd seen there before, and some of the streets had started to get blocked off, and I was able to get in. And you know, there were probably about 1,500 protesters, maybe, in the park and near the street. And around midnight, we kind of got the word that they were coming in, quote unquote, about 12:30, there were 1,400 members of the Los Angeles Police Department, all in helmets, that kind of just showed up. A lot of people by that time fled, so there were basically one protester per, or one cop per protester at that point, and they...
That's the kind of ratio that any parent of a school child would love.
Right, exactly. Isn't that amazing? Yeah, I had something similar, but you know, they were incredibly, intimidating force that kind of showed up. There were, of course, hazmat suits because that was the big line. Viragosa thought that everyone was stinky and dirty, and they had successfully, the protesters, brought the homeless problem to City Hall. The steps of City Hall instead of two blocks away where it's been for the past few decades. Los Angeles has the largest permanent homeless encampment in the world, and it's two blocks away from City Hall, and it's been there forever. It's pretty much no man's land, and they've been camping on the sidewalks there for as long as anyone can remember. The police department or the police station in Skid Row doesn't have any windows. Not bars on the windows, but there's just no windows. It's like a bomb shelter. There's all this kind of lore that that's the place. And if you want to, park in the red zone, you could just can do that in Skid Row because there's no tow truck that would go down there. So the homeless people, it's in this kind of cruel irony of the protesters bringing out wealth inequality and also attracting homelessness at the same time, and that being the reason why the mayor would no longer get the protest. It's cruel. But anyway.
Yeah,
so,
well, I want to talk about that for a second, though, because, it was interesting. I saw earlier in the day, I saw reports that the LAPD was was beginning to stage at Dodger Stadium.
Yeah.
And then I saw some notion, I think it was a CBS story, just as they were beginning to move in on the occupation, saying that the police were worried about feces being thrown at them. Mm-hmm. It really is. That was really the angle that they've used, that every city seems to have used, right? It was just sort of health and safety type of situation. When, of course, there's absolutely zero evidence that there's been any health or safety issues that didn't exist prior to the occupations in all these cities.
Right. Well, the health inspectors were actually at Occupy LA every day. I mean, that was what the occupiers told me, that they were there from, the first week. It was a 61-day occupation, and they were there every day, and every day they would come in, and they would, and the health inspectors would have suggestions or not, and the occupiers would adhere to that because they really wanted to stay in that camp. That's the line, and the local press, or at least the local news, the TV broadcasters, really fed into that, where they, I'm going to post a video later of one of our local yokels going around and going, oh my God, look at all the trash. Which is, who goes to a Dodger game and then it goes to the Dodger, instead of covering the game, they go and cover, the Dodger Stadium, how untidy all the fans are.
Right.
It's just a ridiculous line. But you're absolutely right. It's like, oh, it's filthy. Oh, it's filthy. And it's like, the LAPD has no evidence. And really, they had a six-hour standoff on when they first closed the park. On Sunday night, Monday morning, there were about 2,000 people that just kind of chanted and hung out for 6 hours until they had to the cops had to reopen the street for morning commute traffic. And the only instances of violence were, some kids who showed up and threw bottles at police, and the protesters pushed them out and gave them over to police. And because they, Los Angeles specifically, have said that they are militantly nonviolent. So there were, they have all decided collectively and by group consensus that they are not going to be violent whatsoever. And anybody who perpetrates violence will be given over to police because they do not represent the group. So the police had 6 hours of watching these kids, watching these protesters just not, chant and be lively and express themselves, but not in any way be violent. And so, of course, the local yokels are now saying, you know, well, they're kind of nonviolent, but they did get arrested. And it's like,
right.
Okay, you really do not understand what nonviolent struggle means, because that's kind of the point.
Now, of these local yokels, how many of them ended up in the press pool to get the good coverage of this?
You got it, all of them. Yeah, or, you know, I mean, that was
yeah. Wow, I'm sure that's
healthy. They tried to kick me out of the press pen.
Were you in there?
No, I wasn't in the press pool. I was in the park until midnight. I got a text saying that you need to get out of the park by midnight. So I did that, and I went over to the press pen. I had my press credentials because I'm in 85 newspapers a week. Because the LAPD doesn't think a blog is a real publication yet.
Right.
It's apparently 2003 at the LAPD, if I'm being kind. Anyway, so, I'm a legitimate journalist. I even write for magazines and stuff, you know. Anyway, I had my badge on, my credentials on my chest, and he said, and this cop was kicking some protesters out of the press pen, and he said, you know, where are your credentials? And I showed him, and he said, those aren't the right credentials. I said, yes, they are. And he said, no, those aren't our credentials. And I said, I'm not going to have your credentials because I don't cover crime, I cover politics. And he said, you can't be here without the right credentials. I said, yes, I can. I'm a legitimate journalist, and there's also the First Amendment. And he said, look, that's not my problem. I said, yes, it is, and I have a right to be here. And then he got distracted and walked away. But I was, you know, I mean, it was ridiculous. I mean, really, you're going to check my I was like, do you want to – I can show you my byline if that helps.
My understanding
is – they wanted just their people.
Did you hear this? My understanding is that the people in the press pool were not allowed to tweet during the raid.
I did not hear that. What I heard about that was that they had about 12 people who were in the press pool who would be given protective clothing and a police escort in order to go into the park and film and cover and
protective
do whatever.
Protective
clothing, not hazmat, because there were people there. It was like an effective visual to kind
right.
of make them look like disgusting hippies to have the hazmat suits. But they were given, I guess I'm assuming gas masks or, you know, vests or whatever.
Make it look like there's a reason why we should be –
right,
we're going
like
to justify why we show
yeah.
up looking like the military. It's just basically a way of taking those dupes who go into the pool and make them feel like you're going into a dangerous situation as opposed to just a bunch of people who are incredibly peaceful sitting down and exhausted.
Right. People who've been sleeping in a park and people who are, you know, I mean, this is the whole concept of nonviolent struggle is to break arbitrary rules. And then when the authority doesn't let you or lets you break arbitrary rules without enforcing their rules, which means that their rules mean nothing and you win, or they enforce their arbitrary rules and they look like, you know, douches for, you know, enforcing arbitrary rules. Either way, nonviolence wins the PR war. So the only other way to kind of discredit these people is to make them look like they're filthy.
Right. It's going to be interesting to see what happens as many of the physical occupations end, at least in the short run, and the movement becomes more about the actions it takes, what the criticism is going to be, you know, what the narrative is going to be. Because at this point, the only thing that they've been able to be attacked upon is this idea that there's a hygiene problem or
right.
that there's a safety problem. It's going to be interesting to see what happens when this movement starts to get more involved in foreclosures, starts to get more involved in labor strikes. It's going to be interesting to see what the criticism is.
Well, that's what I've heard from the occupiers who have lost their camp, you know, that they're actually, you know, they're relieved that they can spend less time in what they're calling social services, like feeding people and everybody, you know, within who comes to the park, and more on social action. And so losing the encampment is actually much more liberating in that way, that they can spend their time focusing not on the day-to-day struggle as to, you know, whether or not there's enough hand sanitizer in the camp or personal disputing kind of issues, and more onto, like you said, foreclosures or actions or policy issues or demands or whatever else they're going, because the energy is still there and there's still people, wanting to get involved and wanting to give their time for this movement. But the camping was really a very specific symbol, and it was a very specific kind of person who wanted to spend time in a park, who could spend time in a park and sleep there. I've been covering these things, and like porta potties completely freak me out. I'm surprised, but that's another issue for another time.
We're going to need a different interview for that. One more thing I wanted to just bounce off you was that I've seen that an LAPD commander, that they were taking swabs of people, I guess, presumably in their mouths. With those long Q-tips, and people were assuming they were taking them for DNA testing, but supposedly they were testing them for staph infection. Have you heard anything about that?
Wow, no, I haven't. But again, the visual of them being infected and having these disgusting, cooties, I believe that was on Monday night. Monday morning. That's what everyone kind of. There was somebody on the news who just kind of. Blurted out that they're definitely working with some kind of PR people, because they've been really able to, the LAPD, because they've been pretty good about this by LAPD standards.
Right.
And so that sounds to me, I'm not familiar. Again, I did not hear that report, but I did see them in hazmat suits show up, and that's been the press pool who are. It, in my opinion, complicit with this kind of with this narrative, is that they are disgusting and horrible, filthy people who are, clearly have all sorts of diseases that they're going to spread to anybody who goes to City Hall. The funny thing now is that what used to be an open park for everybody is now gated in. They've erected a fence all around City Hall. And so it's like, they've said the mayor has said that he was going to open it, during certain hours a day for free speech, which, when a government official says, where you can have free speech, it's never good. It's always a bad sign, but now, there's this big fence over it. So City Hall now looks like, it really does belong in an Escape from LA movie.
Well, hopefully they'll rename the square Cootie Free Square.
Right. Sanitized City Hall. Scrubbed of all the blemishes that we could possibly have in the city.
Tina Dupuy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Sam. I hope you feel better.
Thank you. All right, folks. We're going to head to the better half of the program now. I will take your IMs. I'll take your phone calls. But before I do, why not become a Majority Report member? So I can go out and support my SEPA call habit and my emergency habit, get a voice transplant, maybe just hire somebody to talk. Christmas and Hanukkah are coming. Our merch store is open. We've got an ad for it on the majority.fm site. That's also where you can become a member, majority.fm. Also, how about giving us a present? Give us a good review, a rating on iTunes. Apparently, that helps us.
I think what also helps, actually, I've been reading, is the amount of people who subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. So if you've been going to the site and downloading the free podcast individually, just go to iTunes and subscribe to it, and it'll automatically download every day, and you'll be helping us rise in those rankings too, along with the reviews.
And, of course, justcoffee.coop, coffee, tea, chocolate, fair trade, 10% discount with the coupon code MAJORITY. Do everybody a favor, people. Okay, we'll see you tomorrow, if I'm still alive.